I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. So begins the 12th year of this program. What follows are highlights from the last year or so. It's a good way to look back at the show and the sort of guests who've deigned to appear. It's also an exercise in futility in trying to get all the memorable clips from the previous year or other past years. Looking back at the list of 1,190 interviews on average, they've run 20 minutes in length. I'm often reacting with surprise and astonishment, realizing some of the names of the people I've talked to. In what follows, I hope you'll get a sense of the interesting conversations that have broken out on this program over the last year and the decade before that. I'll begin with a remembrance of a previous guest who died recently. Ted McWhinney was a distinguished constitutional expert before he served two terms in the House of Commons as the Member of Parliament for Vancouver Quadra from 1993 to 2000. He appeared on the program in 2006 on the publication of a book, The Governor General and the Prime Minister's The Making and Unmaking of Governments. I picked this clip from the interview because it shows the clarity with which Dr. McWhinney approached constitutional matters. He regularly advised prime ministers and governors general. He was also, as I said, at the time of his death this past May, such a tasteful gossip. You'll hear a little of that in this clip, where I ask him about the role of governor general and the debate over retaining the monarchy in Canada.
By the way, this is one of the problems one has any time one suggests rationalizing the office of governor general, which for all intents and purposes is fully Canadian. Some people confuse it with the monarchy. I think there is a happy element of ambiguity surrounding the monarchy as it stands now. The Queen, for very many people, is Queen of Canada, and if you look at the old British North America Act of 1867, the Constitution Act as it now called, it's there. But the Queen has not obtruded into Canadian political events. In fact, there's been no intrusion by the British monarch for at least 70 years, and I'm not sure that they would want to have it. So I say leave the monarchy out of it, but look at the Governor General, the office proper. If you're going to do away with it, and you could, I think you would have to move to this sort of fusion of the head of state and head of government role. You'd be into much more of a presidential system. Some would say, well, what's wrong with that? Some would even say, don't we have that anyway whenever you get a majority government? The Prime Minister of Canada, if he or she is a strong personality, is stronger than the American president because they control Parliament and you don't have the constitutional checks and balances in the United States. That's such a substantial change, though, that it would require a completely new constitution. I don't think we're dealing with that. My belief is that we can live very comfortably with the system, the titular head of state, the Governor General, and the Prime Minister. And I don't regard the British connection as in any way a problem. I would echo the former Prime Minister, John Chrétien's view, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. I told Mr. Trudeau when the issue came up with some of his earlier constitutional proposals, the monarchy is a distracting issue. If you want to consider the office of Governor General, it involves no implication one way or another for Canada's relations, such as they constitutionally are today with Great Britain. The only role that I can see for the Queen of a substantive character is that she formally, in effect, promulgates the appointment of the Governor-General. But the choice of the Governor-General of Canada has effectively been made by the Prime Minister of Canada since the 1930s.
Ted McWhinney was 91 years old. Last winter, I came across an interview of Harry Shearer on television. He was on the Charlie Rose show to promote a television series he had done in Britain called Nixon's The One. In it, he played Richard Nixon with the dialogue taken from Nixon's infamous Oval Office audio tapes. It was a wonderful series showcasing Shearer's marvelous mimicry of Nixon, providing insight on the president while in the White House. I've long been fascinated with Nixon that I thought to myself, wouldn't it be fun to talk to Shearer about this series? Well, the next morning I asked, and he was booked. This, from January. Did you come away from portraying Nixon, sympathetic seems like the wrong word, but empathetic, say, towards him?
know, it's an odd mixture. As I say, coming from a background where, you know, I was a willing non-participant in the Vietnam War, so I had a very personal interest in the Nixon administration. And he had been this bogeyman figure to California liberals. I grew up in Southern California, and he was always, you know, the personification of what was wrong with the Republican Party. His dirty campaigning, his furtive looks, all of it. One couldn't help thinking and realizing while we were shooting, you know, I'm thinking a lot about the guy. As much as I didn't like a lot of his foreign policy, his domestic policies, much of it were way to the left of the current incumbent Democratic president, which is tells you not so much about Nixon, but about the as we like to say in the United States, the journey we've been on. Mm-hmm. Nixon, by making a bold move to disconnect the southern states from their historical home in the Democratic Party and reroute them in the Republican Party, succeeded in creating a Republican Party that he could not have continued to be a member of. With his policies, he would have been, as we say, primaried out by a Tea Party candidate in 2010 or 2012 or 2014. So there is no home in the modern Republican Party for Richard Nixon. He was not a liberal Republican. He was smack in the middle. Goldwater was to his right. Nelson Rockefeller was to his left. He saw himself as right in the center of the party. As a person, you know, I realized that he had a molten core of burning resentment, some of which had to do with having been born in rural Southern California and looking at all those, you know, smarty pants people in the northeast of the United States who had all the advantages and all the fancy education at the fancy schools and so forth, and made the connections that were going to set them up for life. Total burning resentment of all that. The apotheosis of that world, of course, was the Kennedys, and so when he gets defeated by Kennedy in '60, it's incredibly crushing. He talks in one scene in the show. It's 8 years later, mm-hmm. and he's talking to Kissinger about Kennedy wouldn't invite him to a social event while he was in the White House. And he's still burning up, and nobody bothers to say, Mr. President, Kennedy's dead, and you won. So he didn't have the let-it-go gene, you know. But I realized while we were making the show, you know, I have a little of that. I grew up in Southern California. We're not rural. I grew up in Los Angeles. But I made that same observation that, you know, you do get certain advantages by either growing up in that East Coast corridor or moving there as soon as humanly possible. And you make a choice, something happens if you don't make that choice or if you don't have that advantage. It's not this volcano that it was in Nixon. And I also came to share some of his negative feelings about the news establishment that's based in New York and Washington. I've had an experience in the recent past making a documentary about a major American news story and finding out what really happened and finding some frustration that the East Coast-based media didn't really care to do the follow-up work to report that part of the story. And it affects the city where I live, which is New Orleans, which made it fairly emotional for me. Mm-hmm. So when Nixon wails about the people at the New York Times or the Washington Post or at the networks, there's anti-Semitism in him underlying it. It's not in me. But I share some of little bit of that frustration. So I don't know whether you call that empathy or what, but I mean there were points where I came to a deeper understanding of him. Let's put it that way.
A lot of people have compared Mr. Burns on The Simpsons to Nixon. was that something in mind when you created the voice?
No, not at all. No, Burns is a pretty two-dimensional character by comparison. And you know, that's what's funny about him, is he's just pure evil. But no, Nixon was the farthest thing from my mind at that moment.
And you touched on the few minutes before the resignation speech, which, yeah, which is fascinating. And I mean, I've watched that on C-SPAN over the years, and just enjoyed watching you do it on Nixon's The One. These few minutes before he goes on air, where he's joking around with the crew.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the few moments before he's resigning the presidency of the United States, and he's acting all goofy, and it's just a weird, surreal moment. Your theory on what his behavior was that night is interesting. I mean, I don't know if I totally agree with it, but you think that at that moment he was rehabilitating himself?
I think he was beginning the campaign. You know, I've watched that tape probably hundreds of times.
Yeah.
And one of the things that was really fun about this project was the minute he gets up from the desk and walks away from the camera and the microphone, what he says in the room goes into sort of obscurity for a good minute and a half. And I was, because it was necessary in working with these tapes generally, they're so badly recorded, to use a lot of sound processing to get all the words to come out of the murk. We did the same thing with this scene, and so for the first time you hear really clearly what he's saying to the guys on the crew when he walks away from the desk. But as I say, I'd watched it hundreds of times, and I'd been like you. I thought, oh, it's goofy, it's surreal, it's improbable. This is a guy who had the least gift for small talk, probably of anybody in politics, forget about the presidency, and yet at this moment of approaching ultimate mortification, what does he do? He engages in the most inane small talk. Goofy choice. And it was only when we were in the middle of doing the show and I came upon the tape of this scene ends with the end of the speech, because
yeah,
that was the end of the CBS feed. So one never knew what he was saying, or if anything, after he concluded the speech. But in the midst of rehearsal, I came across a little blog post by somebody who, a White House staffer who'd been in the room that night. And the piece of information that I gleaned from that was the only words that Nixon said after he finished his speech. This was August 8th, and his final words to the room were, "Have a Merry Christmas, fellas." Again, just absolutely goofy, but something struck me about that choice. He knew what date it was, clearly.
Yeah.
So he was planting a seed. What kind of seed was it? He was a guy who prided himself on never giving up and always getting into the next campaign. And I thought at that moment, he is beginning. This is not a goofy choice. This is a choice. He wants the guys on the crew to go home that night and tell their friends and family. He wasn't upset. He wasn't angry. He wasn't depressed. He was a nice guy. He was even joking. He was joking around. He even wished us a Merry Christmas.
Yeah.
And that they would remember that, five months later, at Christmas time. He was beginning the next campaign. I think that's true to his character. It's as good a guess as I can make, because it is true to this guy who always was looking for the next campaign and always was telling people, you never give up. That's when you lose.
Well, one of my favorite Nixon speeches, I guess, is the one the next morning, just before he gets on the helicopter.
My mother was a saint?
Yeah. Others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. I mean,
yeah.
Did you ever think of doing that?
Well, but there's nothing new to add to that, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, the point is not to just, as Nixon would have said, wallow in all this wonderfulness. The point was to, it seemed to me, to bring new material to the public, because very few people are going to go to the trouble of, even though it's all available online, you have to search. There's no transcripts for most of these, so you just have to go fishing, which is what we did. And then the sound quality is so bad that it really, you have to be pretty dedicated to listen to this stuff. So there's nothing new to be brought to the table with that speech, because it's there for everybody to see and hear in pristine analog color.
Mm-hmm.
It is a wonderful, wonderful, mawkish, self-pitying, just imbibing, I would suspect. But, I mean, and the that moment where he says, nobody's ever going to write a book about my mother, but my mother was a saint, to me, just, you know, the first half of that sentence is all about those people who, you know, the East Coast liberal Jewish establishment media will never write a book about this woman. But and then he, you know, apotheosizes her to the skies. You know, she was a saint.
The lesson in booking guests for the program? Just ask. Karen Armstrong is the distinguished writer on faith and religion. She was in town last November, and I talked to her about her book on religion and violence, Fields of Blood. I asked this near the end of our interview. Ms. Armstrong, I want to ask you what you think of Pope Francis and whether you think his time in the papacy will change anything with regards to how the Catholic Church operates, how it's perceived in the wider world.
Well, you know, I really like to see what Francis is doing. He's become a master of the gesture which speaks volumes. More than all the encyclicals and wordy declarations can do. For example, when he went to Israel-Palestine and laid his head in contrition at the wall in Yad Vashem against the Western Wall in Jerusalem, and then did exactly the same thing when he saw when he was taken to the wall that divided the Israel from the West Bank. And that gesture made a huge difference in the Muslim world. It just spoke volumes. I hope he'll be with us for a long time, because the papacy really needed someone like that, someone who is living much more closely to the Gospels. Instead of living in splendor, he's living in a sort of three-star apartment block. With other clerics, not putting himself on a pedestal, making himself accessible to the people. And my fear, however, is that I believe he's not in very good health, and that this is a man who feels that he's got a lot to do in a short time. My fear is that the old guard, the curia, will come down and try to restore the status quo of Benedict the 14th, because that's what happened after John the 23rd at his Vatican Council.
I've interviewed a number of Pulitzer Prize winners, and the latest from last October was the journalist Cheryl Wu Dunn. She and her husband Nicholas Kristof had just published a book, A Path Appears, Transforming Lives, Creating Opportunity. Do you think there is an empathy deficit in our culture today, a compassionate deficit, say?
No, I don't know if it's fair to say a deficit, but we definitely can become a more compassionate people. Already two-thirds of Americans and a large portion of Canadians as well donate to charity. But, you know, often our money isn't necessarily very effectively spent. And, yes, there are some charities that are frauds.
Mm-hmm.
We have to guard against those. And people are suspicious sometimes because they don't know if a charity is a fraud or not. But if we do a little bit of research, in the same way that we research when we buy a car or we buy a TV, we do a lot of research, right? We should also do a little bit more research when we figure out where we want to donate our money. And if you do it with some friends, it becomes a much more interesting social activity and much more fun.
Ayaan Hirsi Ali is a best-selling author and a controversial figure in the discourse. She's a strident critic of radical Islam, and has written a number of books decrying the faith. She spoke to me this past May while on tour in Toronto for her book, Heretic, Why Islam Needs a Reformation Now. You also write in the book about how the left in America especially frustrates you with its response to the oppressed, especially Muslim women.
Yeah, I do, because the left as a movement was all about standing up for the people who are underprivileged and who are weak. And we have a world religion, it's the second largest religion on the planet. And in the name of that religion, women are subjugated, they're second-class citizens, some of them have been turned into slaves. And there's just so much hatred for women that's put in practice so much violence against women in the name of Islam, but instead of standing with the brave women who fight for their rights, we're standing with the clerics who are saying Islam is a religion of peace. What about the gay movement? We're now at a place in the U.S., United States of America, where we're saying, you know, we have to give gay people the same rights as we do. If they want to get married, then we should have recognized those marriages. And I'm a firm believer in that. But what about Muslim gays who are being killed? And it's not just Muslim gays. Just to be homosexual is an offense if you believe that Sharia law is the right moral framework. What about Jews? Anti-Semitism has been revived in the name of Islam to a degree that 10 years, 20 years ago was unthinkable. 1945, after the defeat of National Socialism, we all stood there solemnly saying, never again, mm-hmm. And now it's happening. You know, Jews are feeling so uncomfortable in Europe because of radical Islam that they are considering moving away from Europe to Israel or America or elsewhere. That's a shame. And it's all in the liberal era, in the era of progressives, and that's just crazy.
What do you make of people in the West who get radicalized into Islam? And we hear the argument that they get radicalized because of poverty and marginalization. I mean, is that the reason, you think?
I don't think that's the reason. I think there are a lot of poor people and a lot of marginalized people who are not joining jihad or inventing bad ideas to kill other people in order to improve their lives. The American story, the American narrative was you come here poor and underprivileged and you get an opportunity to work hard and get out of poverty and make, when you have your children and they have their children, life gets steadily better. Now, you can have all kinds of economic discussions or philosophical discussions about that and whether that American dream is alive or not, but you cannot also ignore that parallel. With that is this narrative that Islam, Sharia law, jihad, that is the answer to the problems we face as human beings. And that's being advanced in schools, in colleges, in neighborhoods, in Islamic centers, in all sorts of channels of socialization. And the more we turn away from that, the more we ignore it, the more we are, you know, confronted with these grim facts of young people acting on what they believe. And if what they believe is jihad and they act on it, then we have terrorism and anti-terrorism laws and wars. And I don't know how much of this has to happen before we wake up and think, listen, this is an ideology that we need to fight in the battlefield of ideas.
Jeet here has added much to the discourse in this country and in the United States. Soon after our chat this past February, he became an editor at the New Republic, where he had been contributing regularly. As someone who views culture as you do, does being Canadian factor in the lens that you use in terms of being critical, say, about culture?
That's a very interesting question, because, I mean, there's a whole section of this book that's about Canadian literature. And, yeah, I mean I'm an immigrant, but I do feel like there's something very specifically Canadian in my approach, and I think the figure, well, I was thinking about this with an American writer who was born in Canada, Clive Thompson, whose book I reviewed, and he struck me as taking a very judicious approach of, like, always trying to be balanced and trying to look at competing claims, and he would come to conclusions, but only after sort of weighing them. And there's, like, not all Canadians are like that, but there's a kind of Canadian tradition of, you can see in someone like Northrop Frye that's very much like that, you know, of a kind of, like, a balanced approach.
But you seem to be a writer who can easily write for an American audience at the same time. I mean, is that you do bring some Canadian sensibilities, but you're not overly pronounced as a Canadian, say, if you're writing in the New Republic.
Yeah, no, that's right. I do write for American publications. And to be frank, I think increasingly I'm going to, just because, like, they pay more and the audience is bigger. And, I mean, like, I would love to be able to, you know, like, just make my... to do all of this inside Canada, but I'm not sure if that's, like, really viable. And the other aspect, which is kind of interesting, is, like, you know, like when I write about, like, racial stuff, I find it easier to write for an American audience than a Canadian one. That I think that in Canada, the discourse is kind of like a little bit primitive and unsophisticated, and that the and Canadians are more uncomfortable talking about this stuff, I find. So I do find, like, if I'm writing about anything that has a racial theme, like, it's better to write it for the New Republic than for Canadian publication. I mean, maybe I'm being unfair. I don't know.
Do you think that Canada needs to grow up, say?
I think so, yeah. I think that Canadians are very, I mean, I think the sort of Canadian non-confrontational attitude makes it harder for them to, like, to have honest discussions about race and racism. I think that's right, yeah. And we saw this with the Rob Ford thing because, I mean, it is kind of astonishing, like, how racist Rob Ford was and even Doug Ford and how racist the campaign was, and that this was not, like, front and center of, like, a discussion, right? Like, I mean, you had, you know, Doug Ford supporters who, like, you know, told Olivia Chow to go back to China, right? And you had, like, Rob and Doug, like, constantly making, you know, like, really incendiary. And then they became topics of discussion, but they didn't, like, really, like, define them. And they were kind of able to get away with it, like, in a sense, you know?
Conrad Black was on the program again this past November. He's always a terribly engaging interview. He had just published his History of Canada, and we talked about the various figures he wrote about. The city council here in Vancouver last week declared it Louis Riel Week. In the course of writing this book, did you come to, say, a new assessment of him? Should he have been hanged?
No, he should not have been hanged. It was an outrage. It was the worst mistake McDonald ever made. I don't believe in the death penalty anyway, but he had not done anything to incur a death penalty, even if I believed in such a penalty, and even if he had, it was a politically disastrous thing to do. With that said, Riel himself was not as sympathetic a figure as he seemed. He seemed so because he was executed and he shouldn't have been. And I wouldn't try and shortchange him on that count, being made the supreme sacrifice. But he was a corrupt man and he was mad. You know, he was not a rational person much of the time. And he wasn't, in my opinion, an exactly heroic person, but he was unjustly treated, and I certainly don't begrudge him the celebration he receives. But we shouldn't go overboard here. He wasn't a John Brown figure or something like that. He was a man of absolutely pure motive and a good cause. He had legitimate grievances, but he was a peculiar and a venal person.
Scott Festchuk is one of the funniest writers in Canadian journalism today. His work in Maclean's is a never-miss each week. I've long enjoyed his work, first encountering it in the National Post. He's gone on to write speeches, including working in the office of Paul Martin when Martin was Prime Minister. From December 2014, here's Scott Festchuk.
Hi, Joe. How are you?
Pretty good. Yourself?
Great, thanks.
So were you with Paul Martin the whole time that he was Prime Minister?
I joined shortly after he was sworn in, probably about a month later, but was with him till the end, which didn't come that much later.
Yeah. Were you the one who came up with the idea at the...
I'm already feeling like an ambush in every 60 minutes. Are you the one to blame?
No, well, one of the funnier moments in the last 15, 20 years or so was at the press gallery dinner where Brian Mulroney filmed that piece.
Wow, yes, I'm not sure many people would be familiar with that beyond the press gallery itself, but yeah.
I remember watching that night on I guess, CTV Newsnet, and what it was I guess, Peter C. Newman had just published a book, The Secret Mulroney Tapes.
That's right.
Where it was revealed for a lot of people that Mulroney swore a lot, and so Paul Martin introduces this film, and were you the one who came up with that, though?
I have to admit I was.
Yeah, well, it was great, a great piece of film. Would you tell people about that?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. So the press gallery dinner is something that most leaders do not look forward to because the odds of bombing are much higher than the odds of doing very well because you're expected to be funny, and if you're not, people can be rather merciless. It used to be very much an off-the-record type environment, but now they put it on TV. So it's a little, the stakes are a little bit different and the pressure is a little bit higher. And the secret Mulroney tapes was a really big story at the time, this whole notion that Peter C. Newman had recorded this stuff and kind of without Mulroney's, you know, explicit permission, you know, typed it all up and printed it as a book.
Yeah.
So our idea was, we went to Montreal. At the time, Mulroney was in poor health, and it actually just started back at work the day we did the filming. So he was kind of frail, but I have to say he loved the idea, which was basically a very long build-up. He would say that we would introduce him with the Prime Ministerial logo, former Prime Minister of Canada. He'd be seated in a formal environment. There'd be a big build-up. He'd go, like, party leaders, members of parliament, Supreme Court justices, and this would go on for about a minute.
Yeah.
And then at the end of it, he goes, Peter C. Newman, go fuck yourself. Good night. Yeah. And then it fades out, and that's the end of the whole. The whole speech is just that. And the big debate we got into him with was, would he actually swear on camera? Or would we have to kind of fake it and blame it? And it was, I think it may have been, you know, just a factor of his health at the time and his mentality about the Ottawa Press Gallery. He kept saying to me, you know, if I swear, if you have me saying that, they're just going to be all over me. So in the end, he did swear, but he made us bleep it.
Yeah.
But it didn't, wasn't any less funny. He was a great sport for doing it.
I talked to Suki Kim, the journalist and author, this past March when she was in town to give a TED Talk. She'd just published a memoir of her time working as a teacher to students in an elite school for the sons of officials in the North Korean regime. Her book is a great insight into the future of North Korea.
So what's the connection that you have as the teacher to these students? I mean, there is a bond that develops, isn't there?
Oh, I absolutely adore them. I mean, and I thought about why, you know, they were complicated. You know, they were so adorable and innocent. They were 20 years old, 19. They mm-hmm. seemed younger because they hadn't been able to do anything on their own. They were never allowed to go anywhere. They never saw anything out of their hometown. They didn't know anything about the outside world, or at least pretended they didn't. A lot of them just didn't. And so I think the fact that they were so innocent and we spent so much time together that I did really adore them, but they also, you know, lied all the time because their system is just full of lies. So it's a very disturbing aspect of them, which they just lie for no reason whatsoever, or sometimes just, like, you know, all sorts of lies. But I think with time I began to understand that their system is so inhumane that this is kind of the only way they can survive.
Yeah.
So I think that once I began to understand what the predicament they were in, I did actually, you know, my heart broke for them, and I think that created this immense bond in a way. And they did begin to open up to me, you know, as best as they can in a very subtle way.
And they were interested in you, in your past, your experiences?
I think they never ask things like, you know, what is it like outside? Because they're not allowed to ask that, and somebody's always watching. But I think at some point, you know, I mean, these are just very, very subtle moments when it happens where one student suddenly said, you know, do people treat you badly in America? And I didn't even know what he was asking, and I realized he was talking about racism because I'm Asian American. And that's a concept that doesn't exist there because they don't know about the outside world.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not something that they would have thought about. And I think that as they began to care about me in a way, like they did, because they then said, oh, in America, you know, it's you're Asian, you're Korean, and, you know, other people are not. Are they nice to you?
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's those kind of moments that happened where, you know, they were beginning to think about what it might be to be out in the world, which is, you know, softening of that barrier, because until then, it's all, they're basically, only thing they would say is, like, as if they're robots, you know, great leader stuff, nothing else.
Another fascinating memoir was that by Lucia Jang. In December, I talked to her about her experiences in fleeing the North Korean regime with the journalist Susan McClelland and translator Soo Hyun Nam. She wrote a book, which we all discussed.
And this was this book is, from my understanding, this is sort of a first in terms of the point of view that it comes from, that this is a female experience of the Korean, North Korean regime. Is that correct?
It's my understanding. Certainly there have been other accounts of women coming forward and sharing their stories in the media. There was also a United Nations Commission of Inquiry that some of the women began to come forward with their stories of the trafficking through China, life during the famine, really themselves as a commodity. That part has only recently come to light in terms of a mainstream public knowing that element of the exodus of North Korean women. Certainly it's something that frontline workers and the refugee communities have known about for a long time. So, yes, very much so. It is one of the first accounts in a book format.
Right, right. Lucia, when we hear about North Korea in the media, there's a lot of, I guess we see how North Koreans revere their leaders, and whether it's outbursts of emotion. I guess that's taught at an early age, isn't it, to revere the leaders as North Koreans do, or as they appear to do?
Yes, it is something that is taught from the moment North Koreans are born. We are taught to revere our leaders from an early age, and we have to learn to.
And when was it for you, Lucia, that you came to know better, that you perhaps thought for yourself that the regime wasn't as great as they wanted you to think it was?
I started to think differently after a few years since I first escaped to China.
I see, yeah. And I guess after the end of the Soviet Union into the 1990s, that was pretty bad because famine had spread throughout North Korea. Lucia, for you, how bad did it get? I mean, I understand that you saw people starve to death. Is that correct?
It's difficult to describe in words what I had to witness. At first, children and older people started to die from starvation. And then children and adults alike, they all started to die. It's really difficult to describe how horrible it was.
So what's the feeling of hunger like today? I mean, people get hungry in Canada 2-3 times a day. Has that changed for you? I mean, in Canada generally we have a lot to eat. I know that in the book you describe about what it was like to see all this food when you got to China.
Yes, it definitely feels very different. The kind of hunger that I felt in North Korea and the kind of hunger that I experience now in Canada. When I was in North Korea, the kind of hunger that I experienced and other people experienced is the kind of hunger that erases all thought from your mind. The only thought that is in your mind is that you have to eat. Whereas the hunger that I experience today in Canada is I notice that I'm hungry and I tell myself, okay, I'll get to eat a little bit later. But it wasn't like that when I was in North Korea.
Another moving memoir discussed on the program was that by the activist and former chief of the Fort Albany First Nations, Edmund Metachawabin. He published a harrowing memoir called Up Ghost River about his experiences in a residential school. This, from September 2014.
You knew the first day that you were at St. Anne's. I mean, you were subjected to abuse right from the get-go, right?
I think everybody was given that treatment.
Yeah.
This is now going to be different, so be prepared for that. And I got my first slap within 5 minutes after being registered. I hit the wall, and then that was it. I knew. And it was going to be a different climate of fear and a lot of hitting for absolutely no reason. Whenever she felt like it, when you're walking not the way she liked or smiling to yourself, looking out the window and whispering to your buddy, anything that was that she felt was not within the rules of behavior, then she could hit you as hard and as often as she liked.
This is Sister Wesley.
Sister Wesley, and the other missionaries had the freedom to do that too.
Yeah. You describe in the book the sort of abuse that you got, and as I said, it's a tough book to read, but I mean, it's stuff that we need to know. Mm-hmm. You tell us in the book how bad it got. What did they do to you?
Well, the slaps, if you think of you're about 5 feet eight, strong, muscular woman, and if you picture that, and then you picture your nephew or niece or brother or sister about 7 years old, and you see their the kind of fragility that they have, and you take that person, the adult's right hand, and then you slap them across the ear, across the child's across the ear, and then you use the left hand and come back again, or you take both hands and slap the child over the ears at the same time. And so a lot of us have ringing in our ears. I myself have trouble with my ears, and it's that repeated of creating a vacuum, I think, or just being continuously hit. And so that's a light one. Another one is being made to sit on the electric chair. And it is a metal chair with a wooden seat. It's like a piece of plywood. And you're made to hold the two armrests made of metal. And there's two wires running behind you where one of the missionaries is cranking up a box and to give you a jolt of electricity. So when that electricity hits you, your hands tighten to the armrest, can't let go, and your body's just shaking and your little legs are going up and down in front of you because that's the kind of reaction that you get, especially when your legs are not touching the floor yet. And you hear laughter among the missionaries who are seeing that as a very comical thing that they're seeing. And it's done for entertainment, Saturday nights, and they'd all come and join us at the boys' room. And eventually it became a discipline machine for the girls, or for misbehavior or punishment. They would be put in the electric chair. So that was the physical part. The psychological part is being made to eat your own vomit. And that's, you have to do that yourself. She's not doing lifting the spoon and putting it in your mouth, but you have to. You have no choice. There is no buddy to speak for you. There's no a friend that can come to your rescue, because they will get that treatment if somebody speaks up. Nobody there speaks up. So it's you and the sister, and she tells you to do something, that's what you do. It's bigger than what kind of excuses or defense you can give. So you eat that, it's about 10 to 15 spoonfuls that you put in your mouth, and you learn to eat that. And you cannot bring it back up again,
yeah.
Because that's the worst, substance.
Yeah, you were sick, and then you threw up in the bowl. You were sent for a few days for bed rest, and then you came back, and you were told to finish what was in the bowl.
The bowl was, it was now the morning of the fourth day when I was feeling a lot better. And then I was made to eat the, which was now the fourth morning, that bowl of porridge that had been sitting there at the time I got sick the first time.
Academy Award-winning filmmaker John Zaritsky joined me again last fall when his documentary on eccentrics was released to great acclaim. John, an eccentric himself, talked about the lifespan of eccentrics.
Do eccentrics live longer, John?
They do. That's one of the very interesting facts of Dr. Week's study, was that they live longer and they're healthier and happier than normal people.
Mm-hmm.
And why? Because they don't have the stress of trying to fit in or to belong or to worry or fret about what family or friends or neighbors are thinking about them, all that kind of pressure is off them. And as a result, I mean, statistically, they go to the doctor far less than the rest of society does.
Our society tends to have an odd relationship with eccentrics. We tend to relegate eccentrics away or make fun of them, ostracize them. Why do you think we do that? Do you think it's because we don't understand what eccentricity is?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of things. I think there's some, that they suspect that eccentrics are really rather worthless individuals who don't make a proper contribution to society when, in fact, as you can see in the film, you know, they indeed do everything else but that. I mean, they are very productive, very caring, very giving individuals by and large, and very involved with their society. And I don't know, I think there's also a certain fear of people who are different, you know. I mean, fear, all those stupid fears about are they, you know, mentally ill, or are they sick people, or all that sort of stuff, I think, you know, accounts for some of it. And then, of course, you know, I mean, some of the greatest people of our times have been eccentrics. You know, Alexander Graham Bell, an eccentric. Glenn Gould, eccentric. You know, I mean, but the list is endless. Of, you know, Edison, mm-hmm. you know, Einstein, you know.
Yeah.
All certifiably eccentric in their own rights, but brilliant people, and certainly brilliant people who made a contribution, a huge contribution, regardless of what field they were in, you know.
Here's a couple of interesting chats from this past year. Both authors are in their 90s. Gordon Hawkins just published a biography of British Columbia's eccentric second premier, Amor de Cosmos, and last year, Doris Gregory wrote a memoir about her experience during World War II. They were terrific guests. Here's Mr. Hawkins.
It was a very slow journey, crossing 1,400 miles from one side of the country to the other, and he got very bored and impetuous, impatient, and when he left Salt Lake City with his company, he immediately found everything too slow, so he took off on his own, and he was going through country where drinking water was very scarce indeed. And if you made a mistake and drank some of the alkali-infected water, which was there in abundance, you could really get into a state of delirium, mm-hmm. both you and your horse. And that is what happened to him. So I think that pondering his future as he crossed the country and then going through this epiphany of an experience in the desert, he decided by the time he got to California that he was going to be a different kind of man, create a different kind of self-image, have a persona, a public persona that was assertive and which would enable him to gain power and influence. And that's what he said about doing.
Yeah. And I mean, there's also the argument that Bill Smith is such a common name that...
Yeah, but you see, if you're a common name and you want to change it, what you would normally do is change it to some other name with which you are familiar mm-hmm. to differentiate yourself slightly from Smith. But I mean, Amor de Cosmos, I ask you, you know, front part Latin... N part Greek in the middle is either French or Spanish. What kind of name was that? The guy was on a high. Yeah. He'd come out into California determined to create this new persona. And so he wanted to do it in the most extravagant way that he could. You know, when the senators of Sacramento said, why this name? He said, I'm choosing it because I'm a lover of order, of beauty, of the world, of the universe. I mean, what kind of gobbledygook was that? he was really getting carried away.
Yeah.
And he fitted, he determined that that was the way he was going to go, and he spent the rest of his life defending this newly constructed persona.
And here's Ms. Gregory on the dating scene in Britain during the Second World War.
So in your depiction of the pub scene and the sort of the social life that soldiers had in Britain, would you tell us about some of the hijinks that you servicemen and women got into? I mean, was there a lot of necking and things like that?
There were sure, but it was very what shall I say? Well, I have to tell you that my editor's husband said to her, "What does she mean? She spent 3 years over in England and she never had sex?" And I'm amazed that nobody realizes what life was like for women in the 40s.
Yeah.
We were absolutely terrified of getting pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you did, you risk getting a dishonorable discharge. You would not dare go home, really. And there were some very, very sad stories as a result of all that. One of the worst experiences was when we were down in, I was stationed in Farnborough. This was a camp that was really a huge military camp, in the middle of which there was our company with 100 girls. And it was I had a lovely summer down there because here we were with thousands of good-looking young soldiers wanting to take us out and take us to dances and have us come to their camps for dances and so on. But there were a few girls that got pregnant, but very few, a very small percentage, actually.
Here are a few of the distinguished writers of fiction who've appeared in the last year or so. We begin with Ben Lerner. The American writer is already highly acclaimed. Though he writes fiction, there's a lot of himself in his book, like in his latest, 1004.
Do you think a lot of people that talk to you about the book, interviewers say, or reviewers of the book who write about it, do you think they spend a lot of time or too much time with regards to what is seemingly from your own experience?
Well, I mean, the book invites, I mean, I understand the curiosity because the book, does mix fact and fiction and involves, material from my own life and then is also really distinct in all sorts of ways. What's important is the effect that blurring the boundary between fact and fiction has when you read the book, that it makes, I mean, the goal is to kind of make the reader think about how porous the boundary is between fact and fiction in our own lives, that there isn't, like, reality on the one hand and storytelling on the other, that our experience of reality is determined by the stories we tell about it. But I think, like, the facts of my own life are kind of not really that relevant. Like, I don't think it helps the book to know, that in fact I'm married and have a child in the conventional way and that, Alex is made up or whatever. Like, I think that it helps the book to have a kind of shifting boundary between fact and fiction within the book, but then I think kind of like trying to parse what's true or false in relation to my own life doesn't really add anything to that. In fact, if it resolves the boundary between fact and fiction, I think it can maybe undermine the book a little. The facts of my life aren't that. They're just not that. I don't think they'd be that interesting.
Otherwise, you'd write an autobiography or something
right,
like that.
Exactly.
Now, does the process of writing, whether it's fiction or poetry, does that clarify your own experience or help you understand, say, your own relationships to your work, to life, to other people?
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think, I don't know is the true answer. I mean, I think that there's a way in which that there's a way in which writing fiction lets me take some of my own experiences kind of out of the, you know, the just of chaos and contingency, and to imagine them being given kind of significant form. I mean, I think there is a desire to shape experience through art in a way that makes it more intelligible. But I also want to get out of my experience through writing. You know, I like that I use material from my life, but I don't just want to clarify the real. I want to imagine alternative possibilities, even if they're alternatives that share some features of my life or the world as it is. So there's a weird way where I think it's both about helping me kind of understand elements of my own experience, but also helping me, you know, escape them. And poetry, you know, is a little different for me in the sense that in poetry I'm really kind of, I'm kind of like having a wrestling match with the language, like listening to the push and pull of language, and what I intend to write seems to have very little to do with it in a certain sense. You know, it's for both poetry and prose, the most important thing is what you kind of discover as you write, you know. You know, kind of the social speaks through you, you know, forces bigger than you kind of come out through the bizarre social miracle of language.
Anne-Marie MacDonald has gotten terrific notices for her latest novel, Adult Onset. We spoke last October about how writing fiction has affected her own life and how her own life inspires her fiction.
Now, a lot of authors that I talk to, whether they read fiction or memoirs, say that the actual process of committing words to paper, writing about it, has helped them in their life.
Yes, the truth will set you free.
Does it? Yeah.
It does. You know, but it's not like, oh, I've written these three books, they've all been actually intensely personal, and that's where we find the universal, in the specific. You can't extrapolate. People can't find themselves in a sort of a generalized story. If I, as an author, write something that I think everybody's going to relate to, I'll end up with a generalized kind of mush. I have to write very specifically and very personally and see where that takes me. And only then do you tunnel through to the universal, right? But it's not like I write something and then I feel so much better. Not at all. I just work so bloody hard, and I'm so grateful when I can say, I think this is done. And then I only feel free and, you know, quote-unquote better when I know that the book is a book. It has a life. It is being filtered through other people's points of view. It is becoming part of their autobiography and being changed in the process. That's when I feel good. And I feel like that when I'm an actor. You know, it's one thing to go through a rehearsal process, but you don't know what you've got until it's in front of an audience. And same with being a playwright. The work does not exist until it is shared, until it is communicated. Because art for me is communication. And if I can't articulate it and share it and give it away, then it ain't art.
Now, once the book is published, though, other than talking about it on a book tour, you don't really go back to it, do you? Did you read it again?
No, I've never read any of my books, but I'm thinking at this point, I realized two things when I was approaching the finish line on this book. One was I understood that I was writing about myself in a parallel universe, a self who is struggling to write the third in a trilogy set in a parallel universe featuring a parallel self of her own. So once I'd got caught in that little psychic hall of mirrors, I felt better because I had some distance and I could really charge ahead with the story. The other thing I understood was the little elves and puckish demons of my own psyche, little mischievous elves of my own psyche, had played a trick on myself, because I realized that I was writing the third in my own trilogy, and I hadn't understood that until I was just about finished writing this book, that it actually is the third in a trilogy. Because, I'm going to geek out on my own work right now.
Mm-hmm.
Fall on Your Knees opens in 1899, closes with an epilogue in the early 1960s. The Way the Crow Flies opens in the early 1960s, closes in the first decade of the 21st century, which is where this book is set. This is set in 1 week, around, like, maybe it's like 2011 or something like that.
2012, whatever. It's here and now, but I thought, I've been sneaking up on myself. I have just completed the third in a trilogy.
Yeah.
Like, how is that? It's funny, but just when I think I'm completely self-aware, something like that happens, and I go, you know what? My neocortex is awesome, but it is not the boss.
The American writer Jim Shepard had just published a novel, The Book of Aaron, set in the Warsaw Ghetto during the Holocaust, when I spoke to him this past June.
Did you encounter humor at all?
Oh, I encountered humor all the time. One of the questions I often get now that I'm touring on the book is, were you nervous about injecting humor into the Holocaust? And, of course, I didn't inject any humor into the Holocaust. What I've been trying to do is reflect the humor I find in the Holocaust. And it's not humor in the subject itself. It's humor in the way that the first-person accounts and the accounts of the time are trying to deal with the emotional trauma. I think that there's a way in which, you know, with that kind of trauma, you either find the emotional resourcefulness to deal with it by becoming sociopathic and shutting down your emotions, or you start to, in some ways, find some solace in the absurdity of it and the ironies and that sort of thing. And you see that all the time in the original texts. I was talking to a nonfiction writer, Daniel Mendelsohn, who did his own book about trying to hunt up what happened to his family in mm-hmm. Eastern Poland during the Holocaust, and the book was called The Lost, and he related the story of interviewing an Auschwitz survivor and getting to the end of this his interview and saying, was there anything you want to add, anything that I didn't ask you about? And she said sort of shyly, well, you know, I have the best Auschwitz joke. And he was sort of stunned and said, you have the best Auschwitz joke? What is it? And she said, I made it up. And he said, well, what is it? And she said, when she went back to Auschwitz for the first time, after having resisted doing so for 30 or 40 years, when she finally went back, she was standing in line outside the ladies' room, and a little Polish man asked her for a couple zlotys as a toilet attendant, and she said to him, you know, the last time I was in line here, it was free. And that's the kind of humor I think you encounter all the time when you read the texts, you know, that kind of mordant sort of black humor. And it was part of the way they the people trapped in such untenable positions dealt with being trapped in such a... It's a small way of demonstrating a little bit of power. It's a small way of saying fuck you to the universe. Yeah. It's any number of things.
It was a lot of fun talking to the writer Guy Vanderhaeg, who had just published a collection of short stories this past June.
How often do you teach?
I teach one semester. It's a rather light teaching load,
mm-hmm.
But it sort of gets me out of the house and associating with younger people, which tends to make me trying to consider the art of writing more than perhaps I would if I just had my head buried in what I was doing.
That's at the University of Saskatchewan where you teach, is that right?
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So you do buy into that idea that from your pupils you are taught, I guess, that.
Yeah, I don't think that there's any question about that. I mean, one of the things that I find or have found over 20 years of teaching, that to attempt to explain how fiction is made, and I think of fiction as being a craft, I have to kind of examine very closely what I might do instinctually. And then when I do that, I think that I actually bring a fresher outlook to my own work. When I was a younger writer, I think that I would have thought that there was a danger in thinking about what I was doing, but now that I'm older, I actually see some benefit in it.
Yeah, and I guess as you get older, I read somewhere, I think you told the Ottawa Citizen this, that there is an urgency to return to one's roots. I mean, do you understand the life a little bit better, that you can take the long view and say, look back?
Well, I don't know if I understand it any better. That I get, that might be presumptuous of me to say, but I certainly look at it differently than when I was younger. I think that every age that you inhabit or live gives you a slightly different perspective. And now that I'm in my 60s and approaching my middle 60s, I find that I'm looking back more than I'm looking ahead, which I think is only natural. When I was in my 20s and my 30s and beginning to write, I was trying to imagine myself into the future, or that I had hopes about the future as a writer. Now I'm more inclined to look back on the trajectory that my writing life has taken, and then, you know, my own life. And I think that that's true of anybody as they age. They try to build a narrative out of the life that they've lived.
So I'm just wondering, from your middle 60s, is there no future?
I received a Lifetime Achievement Award about a year ago, and, you know, I said at the banquet in which I got it, you know, does that mean it's all over? I mean, I certainly hope that it isn't all over, but I wouldn't presume to think that I have another 65 years, so it really is a question about, I think, trying to make the most out of the time that's left you. And that's not pessimistic or gloomy or dreary.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's realistic and a way of approaching life.
Patrick Lane and Lorna Crozier both published collections of poems this past year. I've always loved talking to them. Let's take Lorna first from this spring.
In the book, you write about animals a few times. When you write about, say, a bird, as you do in the book, what the bird might be thinking about us humans, I get the sense that you've understood that animal a little differently than most people, perhaps understood it better.
I hope so, Joe. You're talking about the crow one,
yeah.
For instance, where the crow speaks about human beings. I'm feeling, you know, like most humans in this early part of this new century, a lot of despair about our relationships with our fellow creatures and the egomaniacal nature of the human that thinks that we can destroy any habitat and get away with it for the sake of greed, really, for owning more things and producing more things in the world. And so I'm heartbroken. And my way, I guess, of dealing with that heartbreak is to try to honor the animals and write praise poems for them, really, in that kind of superstitious way that poetry knows that maybe if I write about it, I am somehow protecting them, or I'm making people say, hey, wait a minute, this creature is as valuable as I am, and it has sensations, and it has a mind, and it can fly, and I can't, and maybe I should think about that a little bit.
See, I have a rather hostile relationship towards crows, because when I was a kid, walking through the neighborhoods, I guess it was this time of year, I don't know if it's mating season or if they've just hatched, but around this time of year in May, I was walking down the street, and this crow followed me for about a block, you know, swooping down from say, going from the tree to the houses and just following me, and it just frightened me.
Did it attack you? Did it fill your head with its claws?
It tried to.
I've had that happen. That's usually they're protecting their young, and they want you to stay away from where their nests are.
Yeah.
But don't forget, my name is Crozier. I've got a crow in my name.
There you go.
They're just such smart. They're just such smart birds. They're certainly not gentle, and they have some very bad habits, but so do I. Maybe you weren't paying enough attention to it, you know.
That's
maybe
probably it,
that.
Yeah. In reading your poem, I got the sense that you have a great deal of empathy towards crows that I probably don't have.
Well, I hope the poem will change you then, you see. Maybe the poem will make a difference. That's what every poet hopes for, whether it happens or not. But no, I think crows are just fascinating creatures. The fact that they know how to use tools, you know, the fact that they grieve for their dead, that they flock together and just hang around for the fun of it. They obviously have great conversations, and I wish we could understand what they're saying.
Yeah, they seem a lot smarter than, say, other birds that we might see, like pigeons or even seagulls. I mean, seagulls seem resourceful more than anything.
We're yeah, close. And seagulls have been terribly sentimentalized in Jonathan Livingston's Seagull. Remember that book?
Mm-hmm.
So they might be harder to write about from an anthropomorphic point of view. I don't know. But and there are great poems about crows, of course, from the past. I'm thinking of Ted Hughes' book, Crow, where he says that he used the most pared-down, hard, almost ugly language that he could use to write a poem because of the subject matter, and it gave those poems a real edge that he didn't have in the work prior to that.
Yeah, we always think that owls are wise, but I tend to think that crows are a little smarter.
Yeah, and they definitely have a sense of humor, I think.
Yeah. I spoke to Patrick just before Christmas. He was reflective on his career and his work and the stream of awards and adulation that have come his way as of late.
Well, you know, I mean, you're an artist, right? I'm a writer. Other people make pots and paint pictures and, you know, and make video. And, the creative is really the great reward. At the same time, you know, it's like the cult of celebrity and the competition for prizes. I find it very destructive for writers, very destructive for artists generally, that they have to compete. You know, they want the public to respond, so what they do is they name 7 writers to a list, and they say one of these books will win the big prize, and all 7 people show up, and one person gets it. And the moment that person's name's announced, all the TV cameras turn away from the other 6 and focus on the one person, and the other 6 all go home, and they're never talked about. And it's very deflating and very hurtful and very, very hard for artists to deal with the kind of world that the publishing world or the art world can make your life very, very difficult and hard. And a lot of artists, for most artists, they continue to work at their craft regardless of what it is, in spite of those kinds of almost like insults. So getting an honor like this is it's a great honor. It's happened late in my life, and I'm now an officer of the Order of Canada, and my wife's an officer of the Order of Canada. She got it a couple of years ago. And, you think about it before you accept it. I had to think a bit and thought, do I want to accept this or do I want to reject this? And I said, no, I want to take this. I felt that, not because it was my due, but because I think the country does its best to honor its best. And to me, it was an acknowledgement of a life lived, I think. You know, you write and you work for 50 years, and I'm lucky enough to have received a lot of praise for what I've done, you know. But that doesn't change the fact that I'm just a guy who sits in a room, you know, with a pen or, you know, a keyboard and tapping away with his left finger, you know, and that's where the real work gets done. The other stuff is just, you know, they give you these big things just before you die, you know. They don't give them to you when you're 20.
No. But the reading Washita gave me a lot of moments where I sat up and went, oh. And so to be able to talk to you about it and to listen to you read from it was such a thrill today. And to talk to you again, it's a great pleasure.
Joe, you do good work out there. You know, the work you do is good work. You know, you too are an artist, you know. You have your own, everybody has their gifts, and you're a very good interviewer, you know, beyond just me. I've listened to what you do, so. No, it's a pleasure being on the show, you know, to be asked. I'm really proud of this book. It's among the really mature work of my life. I didn't expect to write another book. I had my collected poems out a couple of years ago, and I thought, well, maybe that's it. And then this book happened, and it pleased me greatly to have this book out.
When Patrick Lane says that you two are an artist, Christ, it'll keep you honest for a good several months. Nicola Cavendish is a terrific actress who recently returned to the stage this past fall. She had taken time off to care for her aging father. This from last September.
And so you were away for 2 to 3 years from the acting business, if you will.
Yes.
When you went back to it, did you find that you missed it? Did it feel familiar at the same time?
No, it didn't. I didn't miss it. To be brutally honest, I wondered if it was time to actually give it a miss completely, to really seriously think about something that I've been saying, oh, do I need to do this anymore? It hurts like hell. It hurts your head, my head. It hurts my body. It hurts my, the stress levels are enormous. It's a big text to learn. Learning is not as easy as it was before. I know it's retraining a muscle. There's no question about that. And it's coming now, the confidence is growing, but there's definitely a, it's very frightening. And you do wonder, you get to the age of 62, which I'll be in a month, and you sort of think, well, what, this doesn't need to be all there is. The passion when you were 26 and starting is the excitement, the thrill, the society of it, the, you know, the camaraderie of it. None of that is as important anymore to me as the other part, what's on the other side of the walls, the door that leads to outside of the theater, that outside world is far more enticing and tantalizing. What is paramount still is the responsibility that I have to my audience to understand with clarity and connection and emotional investment and my soul in it the story they're coming to see and their character that they're coming to meet on my back. That will never fade. So I'm dedicated to the work. There's no question about it. Any good actor is. But listen to me sigh. It extracts a lot. Yes, it extracts a lot.
Alan Doyle of Great Big Sea published an acclaimed and terrific memoir of his growing up in Petty Harbor, Newfoundland. He's down to earth and a lot of fun. That comes from where he's from. This from November 2014.
Is that you seem content? And you also feel very lucky. A lot of people find contentment and feeling lucky hard to achieve. Have you got any advice on how to get there?
No, I don't know. It's such default position for me that I have trouble sometimes advising people on how to make themselves happy. You know, it's like, because I've never been anything but happy, you know, like, and it never occurs to me to not be grateful for, I mean, look at the life I have, man.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, it's incredible. Like, I live a charmed, blessed life, and 80 or 90% of it has been given to me by fans. You know, it's been given to me by an audience that I'm so grateful to have, you know, so it's like, you know, if I go around looking like a lucky bastard, it's because I'm a lucky bastard, you know. and I'm not sure, you know. It's like, I think my general attitude that way came from my folks, because they had nothing, mm-hmm. you know, and then to add to nothing, they got four kids, you know. And I don't remember a single hour, man, in my house when I was a kid, when my mother and father weren't anything but, you know, seemed content, you know, and the dad had to hitchhike to work, and, you know, I never seemed to make a big deal about it. He just did it, you know. He just did it and never spent much time dwelling on what was hard, but he spent a whole lot of time dwelling on what was fun.
And finally, we close with two very special guests who appeared in person just this past spring. I've interviewed the distinguished artist Roy Henry Vickers and his collaborator, the writer and historian Robert Budd, before, and each time has been very special. They were just wrapping up their tour and heading home, Vickers to Hazelton up north here in British Columbia, and Lucky to Victoria.
And I could worry that internalized colonization and Indian politics is just going to make a schmozzle out of this whole thing. Or I can say, I am going to Facebook. I am going to tweet. I am going to talk to anybody who will want to listen to me. And when I speak, my speech will be about love and hope and the desire to make this place a better place for all.
Yeah, and the more we speak, the more people join in unison. I mean, and that's our experience every single day.
Every day.
There's joy. People come out of nowhere to just, you know.
6 days and hundreds of people. And the response has always been overwhelmingly positive.
Thank you for helping
hopeful.
Give voice to these things that we yeah. feel, and we're with you.
It must be gratifying, isn't the word, I guess, but it must make you quite pleased at the end of the day that these books have been as successful as they have. But beyond that, because, I mean, you know, people buy books all the time that they don't read. But
yeah.
but these books in particular, these three and then Storyteller last year, have done so well and have touched a lot of people.
It's really funny as people say that to me all the time. It's nice for us to do a tour like this and really feel that. But tonight I'm going to be trying to put my little kids to bed, and tomorrow morning I'm going to wake up, and my little boy, who God bless him, I couldn't love him more, is going to give me a really hard time about eating his breakfast. And, you know, we're living our lives, but, you know, yeah. it's you know, it's nothing, you know, you don't, it's best I can say.
Yeah, and I call home every morning and yeah. every evening, and my dear wife, Andrea, who is a school teacher, she wants to know, okay, who did you meet? And what did you say today? And what was the highlight of the day? And so I get to go through this at the end of each day. And at the end of each day, I'm left with joy.
So life's good, isn't it?
Life's good.
It's good. Yeah. We've got beautiful families. We've got wonderful people in our lives. We both have two incredible wives who make it all necessary. I couldn't be here right now if it wasn't for this woman who is the greatest mom in the world, taking care of our kids and encouraging me to go out and do your thing and then get home and help with bedtime. Impossible without her.
Yeah. And my mom used to say, happiness has to come from inside. And now I know how that happiness can come from inside every day. So I'm glad that we're here, Joe. And
this is a blast. Really.
This has been, for me, such an honor, a privilege, pleasure, whatever you adjective you want to use. You're the writer, Lucky. because I've always delighted to talk to each of you whenever you've got something to promote, but even beyond that.
Just you're a great teacher, Joe. You are a really, really great teacher. Yeah. You go out and you help bring all this information. You ask poignant, wonderful questions. You're very well researched. But this conversation wouldn't be possible without you as well. You're also, you're an amazing teacher.
Doing this show has been a lot of fun over the last 11 years. This past year has been a busy one with a lot of fine guests and fascinating conversations. I only wish I could have included more clips, but there were quite simply so many. After a self-imposed two-month hiatus, returning to the program as I do each September, I am filled with excitement at the year to follow and astonishment at the year that's passed. Looking back, as I do with these anniversary programs, affords me the chance to remember memorable moments, but again to thank the guests, all the guests of the past year, not only them, but the minders, the publicists, the managers, the folks behind the scenes who've helped me get these interviews and this program together. Though I do everything on my own, the producing, the planning, the research, there are people around me who provide encouragement and support, too countless to enumerate. Permit me a few names to single out. Hannah Myers has been a sensible sounding board over the years, as have Eugene Cruz and Mai Tran, not only on matters regarding the program, but all else. Mai and Eugene got married less than a month ago, so a shout out to them. Mai Chan, especially in recent weeks, has been stalwart and steadfast in her kindness. I'll never have enough appreciation for her. To them, and to everyone listening, thank you. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plunter.